Okay, check this out. A report from the Reflective Democracy Campaign, documented by Politico earlier this year, revealed that the Asian American and Pacific Islander community is the least represented demographic in American politics, making up less than 1% of all those who hold office. But that may be starting to change. 2021 has been a historic election year for AAPI communities.
One of my sons asked me the other night if boys can be elected mayor in Boston. They have been, and they will again someday, but not tonight.
That was Michelle Wu, who's just elected as Boston's next mayor. She's the first Asian American and the first woman elected to this role. Aftab Purval was elected as Cincinnati's first Asian American mayor. And five Asian Americans were elected to the New York City Council this year, the largest number of Asian Americans ever to serve together on the council. But the wins have been hard fought, and they come after nearly 2 years of struggle with the rise of anti-Asian hate in the country. Despite being the fastest growing ethnic group in the country, misconceptions about the AAPI community linger, with parts of the AAPI community finding themselves discursively erased in the narrative. For more on this week's historic wins and the issues that members of the AAPI community care about, I spoke with Jane Jun, a professor at the University of Southern California, and Arun Venugopal, who is a senior reporter in the Race and Justice Unit at WNYC. Professor Jun began by giving her analysis on the Boston mayoral race.
Boston is, you know, old school, right, in terms of old Democratic Party politics. But the point here is it was super surprising. This young woman who is, I think prior to that, served on the council and was the president of the council, but prior to that didn't have other political experience. But it's not only a combination of the freshness of the candidate and the newness of the issues, but the progressive coalition that she is bringing, uniting groups that otherwise I think would be difficult to see together and we haven't seen together prior to that in Boston politics.
Yeah. Arun, in New York, voters chose five Asian American candidates for city council, including the first two South Asian elected officials. What does this mean for these communities in New York?
Well, I'll give you one example, Melissa. Jackson Heights is known as one of the most diverse, if not the most diverse, neighborhood in the world. I mean, there's something like 165, 170 languages spoken in this neighborhood. It's never had, to my knowledge, a non-white council member representing this district. And now its incoming council member, Shekhar Krishnan, becomes that first person. He is a person of Indian, South Asian descent. His parents moved here decades ago. And so he represents this shift in political power for South Asians, for people who come from immigrant communities. And that required not just appealing to South Asians in the neighborhood and the district, also building coalitions with people from the Latino community, with white liberals, with immigrants, speaking Spanish to them, reaching out. Same thing with another candidate who just won in Brooklyn. Her name is Shahana Hanif. She's the first Muslim woman to be entering the city council. She appealed through Bangla to this significant proportion of Bangla residents. She used her mom. They had this whole parallel campaign. So all these tactics are being deployed. It's not just about changing demographics. It's about how do you reach these people? How do you engage them and sort of speak to them in a meaningful way?
So I hear, Jane, to come back to you, I hear you talking about this progressive coalition, and I hear Arun talking about kind of this new and fresh and way of speaking across these divisions. But I gotta say, I lived in Louisiana under Bobby Jindal, and I have been a Nikki Haley watcher for a long time. And I want to just sort of dig in a little bit on any kind of, maybe challenging any kind of presumption that the broadly diverse category that is AAPI, much less AAPI elected officials, are all necessarily progressive.
In the 2020 election, two women from California, Michelle Steele and Young Kim, both representing Orange County and parts of it, both defeated Democrats who won in the 2018 interim midterm elections. They're both Republicans and very strong Republicans. So even in California, there's a there is a diversity of opinions and certainly a diversity of party loyalties.
And so, Arun, it brings me to kind of this challenge around both descriptive and substantive representation that I think often emerges for communities of color. Sometimes has been talked about candidates who are not men or queer candidates. How do we balance both the like very real need for and desire for descriptive representation and sort of an interest in one's own ideological representation?
Well, I think this is part of the challenge, and you're seeing this playing out in different ways. Just take the term South Asian itself. Now, this is actually a contested term. It's not like everybody who arrives from, say, Nepal or Bangladesh or Pakistan comes and says, I'm South Asian. It is sort of a socialized process by which people come to embrace a somewhat progressive kind of a set of ideas. And that can sort of manifest in many different ways. But when people refer to themselves as South Asians, there is a certain kind of reaching across the aisle process saying, like, I may be Indian American, but and maybe I'm Hindu, but I actually believe in fighting Islamophobia, for instance, or not just ascribing to model minority sort of notions, you know, the success narrative, and perhaps talking about class solidarity as well, showing up for taxi drivers in the case of New York City, where some of these council members who are South Asian were on the front lines, they were taking part in hunger strikes, because they realized it's very important to do the work of fighting against class exploitation, labor exploitation. And then you have other candidates around the country who basically don't necessarily, you know, they live in much more, segregated neighborhoods. They may be seen as good non-white candidates, and they work for certain systems. When Jane was referring to Young Kim and others, it struck me, I remember like right after the Atlantic killings earlier this year, those congressional hearings addressing hate crimes against Asian Americans, and a bunch of Asian American men and women in office, they sort of towed the party line, the Republican Party line, that, you know, the real problem really isn't all this hate crime. It's really access to higher education in the Ivy Leagues, where they're like fighting us. So it was to me at the time, if you call me naive, it was kind of stunning right after the Atlanta shootings to see that. But you see this other formation happening too. And so these things are playing out increasingly. There are people who definitely speak to, I guess, the power and maintaining power and white supremacy and those kinds of things in new ways, and others who are pushing back.
Now, Jane, I'm interested in thinking not only about some of these wins for candidates, and actually we have a few more to talk about, but also about Asian American voters, AAPI voters, as voters. And, you know, obviously everyone is dissecting in a million different ways what happened in the Virginia gubernatorial election. But I'm wondering if you see any role that could have been played that wasn't by AAPI voters in Virginia, or that in fact manifested and helped to make this decision for a Republican governor in that state.
I don't know that it was a huge surprise, the outcome of that election. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to juxtapose that potentially with New Jersey. And then also, let's think back to the special 2020 election for the Senate races in 21 in Georgia, where Asian American voters are credited in that state with helping to push two Democrats over the top. I think it's a little bit early to say where. We don't have great exit poll data or really great data at all to find out where and how Asian American voters were mobilized, and if they were indeed mobilized, for whom. The size of the population of AAPI voters in both Virginia and New Jersey is larger than in Georgia. And so they form, I think, an important potential swing group of swing voters. And it's important to emphasize the notion of swing, because while Arun is correct, Asian Americans tend to lean Democratic, particularly Indian Americans, who I will note are among the largest immigrant Asian groups in the United States, but also among the newest, with the majority of them arriving in the United States after 1996. You're always going to find Indians who've been here for longer than that, but for the most part, they're a relatively new population and have been much more socialized to Democratic politics. On the flip side, you'll see groups like Vietnamese Americans who vote much more Republican than certainly Indians, and in general, more Republican overall. It helps to account for why you see the wins among, even if tight wins, among Republican candidates in Orange County, which has a large Vietnamese population. So overall, I think it's a little bit early to say the role that Asian Americans played, but note that swing voters are not only people that just decide to change their mind from one election to another, but they might also be swing voters because they're just not sure about the politics yet. And the politics in this meaning, which party do they belong to? One of the largest categories within the a frequency distribution of partisanship among Asian Americans is no preference, not sure, independent. And this is in part because the majority of Asian American voters in the United States are not native born, but foreign born. They're naturalized citizens. It takes a little while to become knowledgeable about politics in the United States.
Arun, I want to sort of zero in just a bit more on South Asians who you've been sort of talking about and giving us some reflections on. What do you think is sort of most frequently misrepresented or misunderstood in media conversations around voters, in addition to elected officials, but voters who are South Asian?
Well, I certainly think that most people can't grasp the incredible diversity within this term. I mean, we're talking about 1.5 to 1.7 billion people, I'm just saying off the top of my head, in that region of South Asia that we're representing incredible linguistic diversity, incredible range of, say, educational experiences, languages, all these things, and just like socio-political backgrounds they're coming from. And when they come here, although we have this sort of notion that many of them are highly educated in this country, that many of them are, making well above the median American income, which many of them are. How do you sort of square that with the fact that many are also in working class neighborhoods? They may be struggling to put, food on the table. They may be dealing with assault, indignities, humiliation on the street or in the workplace or whatever, in ways that many people don't necessarily see or hear about because those stories are not being elevated or told. There's such a range that it's a very unwieldy term. And I don't think we, broadly speaking, really know how to. I mean, even in the community, it's a very kind of like, do we really use this term or not? South Asian as well as Asian American, unwieldy, but so I think that's the problem, that people don't necessarily know how to square the idea of the Indian American doctor making, $500,000 a year with the person who is an undocumented immigrant in Queens, who has a totally different set of problems and ambitions and ideas of what they're dealing with.
Yeah, I'm reminded of recent data showing that in terms of income inequality, that it's actually grown most rapidly within, so internal to that broad and diverse category that is AAPI, right? That and so if you think just of income as indicating sort of one understanding of a group of people, right, that both the highest one-fifth and the lowest, quintile represented, with this kind of broad category. It's such an odd, in the American racial binary, right? Sort of what we do with AAPI as a political identity.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's going to be a long time before we understand, even within AAPI issues, like how formative this pandemic is going to be. I think it's going to take time for us to understand that. I'm just thinking of one of these five new Asian Americans entering the city council in New York City. One of them, Julie Wan, I met her at a protest against anti-Asian violence that happened earlier this year. She wasn't there by herself. She was there with a companion, a non-Asian companion, who she said is her sort of bodyguard, like one of several. She says, I don't leave my home without a non-Asian companion because I feel so unsafe. I've also taken up jujitsu, which I started learning as a kid. But that sense of threat, of potential violence, it's very real for a lot of people in the community. And I think also it's sort of a very fast and harsh sort of a training in, the history of this country and what imperialism means and how, you can be three or four generations into living here, but you're still otherized, as we saw all too, clearly with what's happened with the so-called Chinese flu, this kind of stuff that's deployed so easily. I think I think these are the issues that are really going to, you know, potentially drive young people who are coming of age at this moment and convince them that the only way to change these things is to acquire power.
Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks, Melissa.
Thank you.
That was Professor Jane Jun from the University of Southern California and Arun Venugopal, senior reporter in the Race and Justice Unit at WNYC.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.